Sabrina.
Hi, Cassia. How are you?
I am good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I am feeling like things are starting to get back to a good, healthy swing. Let's hope that that stays the case for a while.
Absolutely. I have to acknowledge that I'm currently recording this like squatting in my bedroom, which is not how I usually roll. The irony being that I kind of pushed my kids downstairs and begged them to be quiet for a few minutes.
Did you have to bribe them or you just begged?
Not yet. I'm one step away.
Okay.
I'm willing to. But the topic of today's conversation is all about silencing women, which I was just like, shh, be quiet, just for 5 minutes. But I want to talk about double standards because I think it exists all around us in a lot of different ways for men and women, for boys and girls. But the one that I think is really interesting that the focus of this conversation in this episode today is about is the ways that we silence girls, where we expect young boys, men, to be loud, to lean into those leadership qualities, to be bold. And we silence those in girls from a very young age. And I think that's still happening all around us.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is the reality of this podcast is that every single conversation, regardless of the topic, regardless of where our guests are from in the world, every single conversation has a very large element of double standards, right? And the way that we deal with that in young girls in their upbringing and the way that we treat, and this is even still represented in film and pop culture and like all these things that we're just seeing constantly, and the ways that we are taking in the information from society is still so prevalent that the boys are encouraged to act one way and the girls are encouraged to act a different way, or discouraged, I should say, to act certain ways. And we're still doing that to our kids.
And I think it has a really, really lasting effect on how they go about their life and the roles that they fill and the way that they use their voices. I got to have the most fascinating conversation this week with Phumzile Van Dam. She grew up in South Africa. She currently lives in Oslo, Norway. And she has been told her entire career to be quieter, to not speak up, to not leverage her influence, to be smaller in all of the ways. And she is anything but. She is this huge personality, and she has had such a global voice and influence. And she attributes a lot of that to the women around her growing up. Her mother and her grandmother were the exact same way.
And I think the fact that she happens to be a Black woman also in politics and as an activist is additional layer in terms of how we treat Black women or women of color who have loud voices and loud personalities. But she needed to have that kind of presence in order to push through some of the things that she did. And I think what we're going to hear is how important that was for her in her life and in her career.
I mean, the personality traits that she leaned into and took full advantage of enabled her to be elected as a member of parliament for South Africa at age 31. That was huge.
So young. Wow.
Yeah. Incredible. She was part of a movement of women that have slowly filled these leadership positions in South Africa. And we talk about the influence that it's had. But we also talk about how hard it has been and the many ways in which she's had to work harder than her male peers to leverage that influence, to activate her voice, to be a voice for all of the other Black women around her, and all of the attempts that have been made to push her out.
Well, I haven't seen you be this jazzed about a conversation in a while, so I am super excited to hear it.
It is awesome. It is awesome. She's an inspiration, you guys. There is so much to learn from this conversation with Phumzile, so go ahead and take a listen. Phumzile, thank you so, so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to our chats.
Yeah, and I should clarify, it's, 8:30 in the morning here in Denver, Colorado. That is not the case where you are in Oslo, Norway.
No, it's almost 4 p.m. And it's almost a it's time for coffee for you, but it's a time for a glass of wine for me.
I was going to say cocktail time. I mean, feel free to pour something. The conversation will only get better. It will only improve.
Maybe I will.
I no judgment here, truly. So I am super, super excited to have this conversation with you. We're going to be talking about all the things, everything from politics to disinformation to your experience growing up in South Africa. But I want to start at the beginning. I really want to hear more about what you were like as a little girl.
So I was a very quiet and shy little girl, which I still am, and people don't believe that. I'm shy. I'm an introvert. You know, I am able to kind of give bursts of energy to my different passions, but I need a long time to recharge my batteries. So as a little girl, I was that way. But the only time I would kind of, you know, speak up in public is when I encountered injustice. I always tell people that I had my first protest, my first strike in fifth grade. So our teacher, I don't know what had happened in the classroom, but she said no break time for us, no recess. And I thought this is a huge injustice. I got my classmates to make placards.
I love this.
Yeah, in fifth grade, I got all my classmates to make placards. I don't remember what we wrote, but it was basically expressing our great dissatisfaction with this decision that was made. And I got into so much trouble, went to the principal's office. My parents were called in, you know, picked me up from school on the drive home. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm in such big trouble. You know, I was kind of tense all the way home. And my parents didn't say anything until years later. And my mother told me she was proud of me.
Oh, I love that. Why do you think it took her years?
I don't know. I think she herself was kind of involved in the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. So she lived in Swaziland, which is a small country next to South Africa. And she was a student. And she used to do kind of underground covert missions. And this was something she didn't really speak about. But I think she kind of, at an early age, encouraged our activism. She encouraged my independence. So I think it was just her saying, look, I'm really okay with you speaking up when you see something wrong. It's not like she was grooming me for a career in politics, not at all. But I think she was just, you know, encouraging that kind of spirit of activism, of speaking up against injustice. I'd actually forgotten that story. And people always ask me, when did your activism start? And I was like, in fifth grade.
Fifth grade? Yeah, recess over the most important things.
Yeah, it was quite crazy. So, yeah.
Did your classmates love you? Did they adore you? Were you so celebrated?
I don't actually even remember a lot of those details. I think it's kind of the memories also been taken over by the trauma of being taken to the principal's office and wondering why my parents didn't say anything. Did they forget? Did they know? I don't remember that. It was quite crazy. So, yeah.
So in the U.S., at least, we talk about kind of the double standard that still exists for boys and girls' personalities and the fact that we celebrate, you know, the loud leadership quality in little boys still. And we work really hard, unfortunately, to silence it in little girls. Despite best efforts, I think that's still very apparent. Did you experience this? I mean, were there nicknames? Was there any backlash for those bold leadership qualities?
My childhood, I will say no, because I grew up in a family where speaking up was encouraged. I spent a lot of time with my grandmother, and she emphasized a lot that we were equal. Give an example. So we often have traditional ceremonies. So there was a slaughtering of a cow, and my uncles and my cousins were kind of part of that. And one of my uncles says, go away, this is men's work, you're not supposed to be here. So I went to my grandmother and I told her this. She was very upset. She got up and she said, there's no such thing. Go and get involved. There's no such thing as this is men's work. This is women's work. I actually have a lot of her personality. So she, for example, they would have community meetings and women were not allowed to speak. And she would always speak. My grandfather would kind of recoil in embarrassment, but she'd get up and speak, and she was kind of well known in the neighborhood for this woman who takes no nonsense from everyone, from anyone. So from my childhood, I didn't really experience much of that. I think I only experienced it when I actually was an adult and I went into formal politics. And it was such a difficult concept for me to process, having been brought up in an environment where speaking up was celebrated and encouraged, and my gender didn't matter at all. So that's when I experienced it, and I think it was subject of a lot of psychological torment, because it required me to go against kind of what I was taught from a very young age and go against who I am, which is I speak up, and I'm not afraid to.
And we're going to dive into that. I think it's going to really be the focus of the conversation. But before we do, I want to understand better. I mean, clearly your mother and your grandmother were huge influences on you. However, you know, subtly and subconsciously, I mean, their activism, their voices, their, you know, complete commitment to speaking their mind as they saw fit. Was there backlash on them? I mean, I have to imagine they were of a generation where that was not the norm.
So my grandmother was born in the 1920s and my mom in the 1960s, just to kind of frame the generation. And my grandmother lived in very like traditional rural South Africa, Africa. And my mom was more kind of a more modern kind of hippie era, if you will, 70s, 80s. And there haven't been stories of a lot of backlash from my grandmother. I think she was like a larger than life personality. And like I was saying, she was well known in the neighborhood. You know, if something happened, we'd just go to my grandmother and be like, that person said this, and she'd get up. And she was like a short, stocky woman, and she'd march. She was very defensive over her over her family. And my mother, you know, they never spoke about any backlash. I think they both made a concerted effort to, I don't know if it's protect us from that kind of world. But yeah, I'm actually for the first time thinking about this.
Well, and it's like, I feel like as grown women, we have a lot of conversations, or at least in my experience with my mother and my grandmother now as adults, that I didn't have, obviously, growing up, you know, and I get a window into their lives and their realities. And I just wonder if that's been something that you guys have bonded over, or if there's been, you know, kind of shared trauma over, you know, social backlash and things like that. But maybe that hasn't been the case.
No, my mom was very kind of different. She always swam upstream. And that for me, at a time, you know, when you're trying to fit in, it was difficult because, you know, kids will always ask, oh, your mom, look at the decor in your house. Why is it look? Because she collected a lot of vintage furniture and art and books. And I'm like, wow. Your family's house looks like a museum. Why does it look like this? You know, my mom was very different. And I would see the social backlash. And obviously it was uncomfortable to have kids ask you all these questions about being different. Yeah, and that's not something we've really discussed. But I was brought up with trying to build an individual and be different. For example, my mom refused to buy Barbie dolls for me. And she said, you know, that creates unfair perceptions of beauty. I was 10, I didn't know.
But that's amazing. I mean, hell yeah. Good on her for kind of setting those boundaries and, you know.
But at the time I was like, I really, this sounds amazing. But I would really like a Barbie doll.
I hear you, and also I still want the doll.
I get it. I don't get it at all, but I would like a Barbie doll because everyone else has one, and me having to explain why I don't have one. But now that I'm an adult, you know, these things make sense now.
I love that. So I want to talk about the kind of gender discrimination landscape at large. I mean, South Africa has had such a public experience and struggle with race dynamics and discrimination. You know, apartheid was obviously a system of institutionalized racism in the country that ended in the early 90s. But the gender discrimination, the history thereof, the evolution thereof has been far less public. What has that looked like and how has it evolved differently for Black women and white women in the country?
You know, it's kind of a painful subject for me. You know, I was young, Black and female in politics, you know, firstly an arena that is traditionally a little bit older, that is traditionally a little bit more male. And I came in with my big opinions and my, you know, everything that I am. And just having things like being interrupted when you're speaking, being told you're so emotional, you're so aggressive, and all those things. And I really worked hard and aimed to do well in my job. I was a workhorse. And then when I started doing well, then was suddenly all these attacks, and I didn't understand it. There were, you know, attacks of people feeling threatened. What is she? She's so good. What does she want to do? Does she want to be in power? Does she want to take over her positions? That there was a lot of, yeah, the attacks. I just didn't understand them because I was like, I'm doing well. I'm doing my job. Why are you attacking me? Why are all these narratives out there about me? Why is this narrative that I'm aggressive? I'm not aggressive. I'm just forthright. And, you know, a person will know where they stand with me because I will tell you. So that was my experience. And I know it's an experience of many other young Black women, not only in politics and corporate, in the private sector. So South Africa is a society, for example, where it has one of the highest rates of gender-based violence. So there's, I wouldn't say it's a patriarchal country, because I think that's a little bit a simplistic way of viewing it. But I think there is kind of the same culture that views people of color as substandard. The same kind of culture exists with women. And even though it's not as expressed, it's more little things. You know, that when you're a woman walking down the streets, you don't know whether this is the day you're going to be raped or murdered. And just the act of walking down the streets and all the things you need to think through. Okay, I need to have a 360 view of what's happening all around me. There's that man walking down the street. What's his body language? Is he coming close to me? So it's the daily trauma of being a woman and not really feeling safe. And the conversation happens continuously, but it's to see the kind of national trauma that conversations around gender are, is that there will be a big case about a young woman murdered or raped, and then there will be this groundswell of speaking up and, you know, countrywide protests, and then it just doesn't really go anywhere.
It's interesting to hear you say simultaneously that the country has one of the highest rates of gender violence, and also that you yourself and thousands of women around you experience criticism for being too aggressive, you know, and too loud and too emotional. And those are criticisms thrown at women all over the world. You know, we had a fascinating conversation with Dr. Winnie Kiru, who, if you haven't met, you should meet, is one of the leaders in wildlife conservation out of Kenya. And she was relaying the exact same thing of all of the years of criticism she got for being too emotional, and how instead that's been a real strength for her in her career.
I think the experience of women across the globe in the workplace, in just social settings, I think it would pretty much be similar, which is strange given that, you know, different countries are in different stages of social and economic development, and you'd expect that in a country where there's widespread education, that there'd be less of that kind of attitude. I think the violence is also, you know, there's different types of violence. There's a psychological violence, the psychological abuse, and there's physical abuse. So in countries that are violent, where there's high murder rates, the violence against women will tend to be more physical. You know, there's high rates of femicide where, and I don't know what the stats are in the US, but I've read that there's high rates of femicide when a woman is killed. The first person that is looked at is their partner. So I think it takes different types of violence. It's violence nonetheless. You know, it is psychological violence to go as a woman in a workplace and be put down and, you know, be denied opportunities to progress. You know, going every day into work and you know every day is going to be a battle. That is violence. And I think we need to kind of start talking about the different kinds of violence and not only just limit our conversation to physical violence and talking more about it's psychological abuse. And I think maybe framing the conversation about the manner in which women are described as, you know, aggressive and she's a B word, she's this, she's that. And we sort of move that conversation into, because sometimes people need to be jarred in order to change. It needs to be jarring and say, the way that I'm treated is a form of psychological abuse. It's trauma. And the trauma stems from that kind of abuse. And I think maybe we need to start speaking in more of those stronger terms.
So let's talk about your career in politics.
Yeah.
In 2004, President Thabo Mbeki said no government in South Africa could ever claim to represent the will of the people if it failed to address the central task of emancipation of women in all its elements. And that includes the government we are privileged to lead. I want to talk about why you decided to go into politics.
So I was studying political science and law, and I was kind of almost done with my law degree. And civil procedure, which is kind of very strict and you need to be within the rules. And my natural, I don't know, my personality is to rebel. I like to be given space and creativity to come up with ideas. And I kind of finished university and I didn't really know what to do. I was kind of, you know, still elected into positions and I thought of going into politics. And my idea wasn't to become kind of elected. I worked for many years as a political staffer. But obviously through the years of working as a political staffer, I realized that maybe this is something I'd like to do. So it wasn't kind of a dream that I had from a very young age that I followed. It was something I kind of landed into by accident. But obviously as I was in this political career, I worked towards being elected because it was something that I decided I wanted to do. And I think my personality and my beliefs and my principles, I'm very, I'm a principled person. And the way I make my decisions is a very principled way. So I realized that I had these traits that would mean I would do well in politics while also fighting this being an introvert. And I remember my very first speech in parliament, and it was like a really big debate. It was a state of the nation. So I spoke on behalf of the opposition and I was so nervous. I remember I was holding onto my papers so tightly because I was shaking, and then realizing, oh my gosh, I have to turn the page, and my hand kind of going out of control and doing its own thing. It's like, oh, hand, please.
You guys, our audience cannot see you right now, but the hands are flailing.
Yes, there's this movie where they like have the hand. There's a Jim Carrey movie where it's like the hand. I can't control it. But yeah, I mean, it was challenging in that I had to learn how to break out of my shell. And I had a big public speaking fear. And so it was kind of a challenge to myself. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. And I thought I ended up doing it quite well. I love my job.
I would like the record to show that I would prefer if I was only surrounded by rebellious girls for the rest of my life. Like, yes, everything you are describing about your personality and the dance you are currently doing in the background, like that is what I want, right? Surround me with women who aren't afraid to speak their mind, who are going to stand in front of the crowd even as their hands are shaking, right? Because the fear doesn't go away. That's real. We're human. But we do it anyway. So I just want to applaud you for leaning into those personality traits, but then also, you know, moving past the fear to do that hard work. In 2014, you were elected to parliament at the age of 31, and you helped break a gender barrier that once confined women to only 3% of the lawmaking body in South Africa. Today, 42% of all seats in South African parliament are held by women. What was responsible for that change?
So they have quotas, but I guess the real measure of it is the impact that women can have in parliament. So for example, the ruling party has never had a female president. And I think a few years ago, they had an internal congress. And the women's league, so the women's body or whatever. And they said, we're not ready for my female president yet.
Nor are we. So I get it.
Yeah. So there's a bias from the men and then the women thinking some women, because they tend to be a little bit older, still stuck in those beliefs. So the discrimination that I really received, for example, that you're so aggressive, you're so this, you need to change the way you speak, was from a lot of older women.
Isn't that interesting that that's being passed down between generations of women, despite your generation working so hard to claw your way into that space?
Yeah. So it's fighting an institution, you're fighting patriarchy as an institution. And those beliefs don't only come from men, but from women, you know. You need to speak softer. Don't be so aggressive. I remember this man when I first came into parliament, brand new, and I had red lipstick. And this woman, member of parliament, she was a woman. I really looked up at her. She was really, really great. And, you know, she could stand at the podium without a speech and speak. And when she came when we were outside, she came with her husband. And the husband said, and I had red lipstick, and he said, people don't like progressive women. Don't wear such bright lipstick. They're never going to take you seriously. And this woman who I saw and I thought was so powerful and I looked up to, and then seeing that her husband basically kind of had her under his thumb, I think it was very jarring for me. And also just a point of rebellion, because I was like, red lipstick, pink lipstick, very bright lipstick all the time.
I have some lipstick.
How dare you? How dare you? But yeah, I think that was an early experience where I was like, wow. So I'm supposed to change who I am to be acceptable. I'm going to just do the exact opposite. I'm not going to be acceptable anymore. And I'm going to make people uncomfortable and so that we can have these difficult conversations.
How did that serve you? What was the response?
Look, it wasn't easy. I will not lie. It was not easy. It was difficult because it put me in a permanent state of fight or flight. But I started putting myself in this frame of mind where I was like, I'm not really doing this for me. It's going to be difficult for me. It's always going to be difficult. But I need to do it for the younger people that are going to come behind me. because I'd seen young people come in and be bullied into submission. And because it was not possible to bully me into submission because I'd always fight back, I just started saying, you know, I am going to be under fire a lot all the time, and it's okay. This is not about me anymore. It stopped being about me. It's so that younger people can come into the space and do well and not have to put up with the things that I've had to put up with, because I've been there and they've seen me fight back. That not only do I make it, I change the kind of bullies in the workplace. They know that, you know, people will fight back, and people have seen me fighting back, that people will fight back. So it wasn't easy. I set myself on fire to keep people warm until it was just no longer feasible.
What has the impact of your sacrifice, your willingness to stand in that fire, alongside presumably that of many other women, you know, as that number has moved from 3 to 42%, like, there must have been other women subject to similar discrimination, similar criticism, constant, you know, undermining. But what has the impact of that body of women been on the country? You know, we've had conversations, several in last season about the pure presence of women at the table changes things because they make decisions differently. They value things differently. Their experience of the world and the lens that they look through is different. And that changes things. What has been your experience of that? What have you seen happen? Has kind of, you know, the fire that you stood in, the burns that you experienced, was that worth it? Has the needle moved in any meaningful way?
I hope it has. You know, I can't definitively say, you know, things have changed because of me, but I've noticed, and just the way people are more comfortable with claiming their space, the way that, you know, the progress that I would never have seen before, I've seen happen. I think I only left in May 2021, so it's been difficult to kind of, at least from my contribution, it's been difficult to tell how much it has changed, but I know that people are treated better, and things are kinder for people, because I fought, and that was the point, because I just said, look, stop being about me. I just want them to know that they can't treat people this way, because people will always fight back and will fight back. And I think they've realized that, you know, it's not worth it. And while not everyone's like me, they know that they have the potential to be like me. They have the potential to be, you know, a person who doesn't mind turning over dustbins and setting them on fire, metaphorically.
And writing with lipstick on the wall.
Exactly. Turning over the dustbins, making people uncomfortable. And
what has been the landscape of gender policy at large? Is that starting to shift? Do you see the presence of women in the lawmaking body actually starting to change things for the better?
Oh, definitely. There's a lot of women, women in leadership positions. And I've never felt kind of, for me, it was more microaggressions. I never felt like my voice didn't matter because of a woman. And I think women have a seat at the table and can speak up, and they listen to. I mean, I was listened to, because once people got over, you know, the how I speak and how I carry myself, they valued me because once they got past that, they could listen to what I was saying and my words. And I think a lot of women are well respected in politics. I think it's more microaggressions. I think you're right. It's less kind of like, you're a woman, your opinion doesn't matter, we won't listen to you. It's just you have to fight a little bit more for him to work twice as hard to be taken seriously. And that's in particular for young women, young black women. You know, young black is like a double whammy, you know. Twice the hurdles you need to overcome.
A big reason why I wanted to have this conversation was to talk about the power and influence of women's voices, which we're already tiptoeing around, if you will. Your voice is clearly incredibly loud, incredibly powerful. You were appointed national spokesperson for your party at one point. What influence did that afford you? What did that platform allow you to do?
So that platform allowed me to overcome a lot of my fears, because a lot of it was spokesperson. I needed to speak. I think it was a time of growth. Obviously, I didn't think I was suitable for the position in which, you know, I was surprised when I was asked to take on that position.
Why were you surprised? Why was the bold, rebellious girl surprised?
I don't know. Maybe it's just I didn't think I was that capable. But they obviously saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. But it was an opportunity to really overcome some fears. I grew a lot from the position. I mean, I served, it's a very tough position because you have to constantly be available, because you're constantly available, constantly aware of what's happening in the news, aware of risks. I was the longest serving at 4 years because people don't do it past 2 years because of how grueling it is. But yeah, I think it was an opportunity to overcome a lot of my fears and stand in my truth.
It's interesting to hear you talk about your struggle with self-confidence. You know, you described yourself as an introvert earlier, you know, in direct kind of opposition to some of these bold, rebellious personality traits that you've talked about, the fact that it just takes you a long time then to recharge. You're willing to do that. You'll lean into that. But then you need the time and the space. And now I hear you talk about self-confidence. And despite the fact that you were elected to such prestigious positions or appointed to such prestigious positions and serving your country, you know, as a member of parliament, and yet you still felt inadequate. You know, you still struggled to feel your own sense of worth and to feel capable at doing this job. And you're not alone in that, right? Like, I think we've had conversations with women all over the world who are at the peak of their careers and still wrestle with this sense of inadequacy and
imposter syndrome.
Yeah, it's real.
Yeah. I have anxiety, so I'm a very anxious person. I've got chronic anxiety, and I guess that's where I have a huge inner critic.
How do you quiet it?
I'm learning. I don't know how to. I don't always know how to. I go to therapy. It's hard to silence, and can be debilitating. But also, I guess this is probably a weird thing to say, but my anxiety has actually helped me do well in my job, because it means I over-prepare. I prepare a lot, and I think, okay, this could go wrong. How do I prepare for this eventuality? So it's helped in that way, but also it has drained me of a lot of energy. So it's helped me grow, but that inner critic, I don't know if I silence it. I only silence it by being prepared. But also I think it lights a fire in my belly to say, I am going to do well. I am going to make sure I do well. I don't think I will ever go away. It's part of who I am, and finding a way to live in comfort with the inner critic and to be able to have a conversation of kindness with yourself and your inner critic to say, no, actually, I can do this. You need to shut up. keep quiet. I do know this subject matter. I can go and speak about it. I think ahead of every interview, I struggle. Even today, I was like, what am I going to say? Am I going to be interesting? Do I need to prepare? No, don't prepare. Just go be yourself. But I think that's something a lot of people struggle with. But I'm happy that discussing issues of mental health has become more mainstream, if I must use a word. And I think talking about it helps. Because people will see you and think, oh my God, that person's so well put together. They know what they're doing. And it's like, whoa, man, I have anxiety. I struggle with my anxiety. I think I'm imposter syndrome chokes me at times. So I'm grateful for that one generational development, if I could say it that way, of being far more open about mental health. Because I think it helps a lot of people to know that I'm not alone. And he has this person, I think they have their life together. It's like, not many people know what they're doing, man. A lot of people don't know what they're doing. A lot of people are struggling, and we're all just out here trying to do our best.
There's a connection here, right? Like, I hear you talk about you having to silence your own anxiety and you having to tell that to shut up, you know, that you're better than that and you're showing up anyway. And I look at that inner battle that you have struggled with, that you're telling us about and kind of opening up about right now. And I think, good God, like, you had to fight that every day to do the work that you are doing. The last thing you needed was a system around you also telling you to be quiet, to shut up, to silence that voice and that influence. And yet that was kind of the common theme of your political career, was battling a system around you trying to make you quieter and smaller, and a little less effective at what you were doing.
That's what it was, and the way I responded was just to fight back. I fought.
I want to talk about one of those fights, because there was a moment in your career where you moved from being a figure of national recognition and influence to really starting to get some global recognition. What can you tell us about the moment when you decided to hold the British PR firm responsible for spreading racist propaganda? Give our audience a summary of that campaign and that fight. And then I want to talk about all of the ripple effect.
Yeah, so it was Bell Pottinger. It was a big UK-based PR firm. They did work for the Pentagon, contracted in the billions. They were Margaret Thatcher's PR. So what they did was they were hired by friends of former President Jacob Zuma, and his era of presidency was filled with corruption. So they were hired by this family to come and kind of clean up their image. And they ran a campaign in South Africa that had the effect of pitting South Africans' different racial groups against each other. So they sought, for example, to blame white people for South Africa's lack of economic progress. You know, it's a bit more nuanced than that. You know, there's institutionalized racism, but there's also years of corruption that have resulted in, you know, people not being able to move out of poverty. So what happened was that there was a leak of documents, and Bell Pottinger's contract with the Gupta family, they were called, was made public. And the response from South Africans was those rare moments when people put their racial differences aside and said, hell no, you will not do this in our backyard. You will not come in as a UK-based PR firm and kind of try and, you know, use our racial differences and our racial fears and our racial insecurities. You will not use those to pit us against each other. So there was quite a lot of public response to that, so much so that Bell Pottinger shut down their social media accounts. So, yeah, and then I had a researcher, my researcher and I looked at ways to try and see if there was a way to hold Bell Pottinger accountable. So then we saw that they belonged to there was a PR a trade body in the UK. And if you were kind of a PR firm, you belonged to this body, you needed to abide by the rules. And then we saw that they violated their rules. So there was a lot of, so we submitted a complaint, and a lot of the work between then and the actual kind of case when the matter was heard was a lot of actual PR to get the story out there, to get it out to an international audience. And I remember a journalist talking to me and saying, well, isn't what Bell Pottinger did just, well, PR? And I was like, no, it's not, you know? It has to be ethical. And how you do your PR has to be ethical. So we helped kind of start a conversation internationally about ethics, in the PR industry, about being held accountable for disinformation, because Bell Pottinger used a lot of disinformation in their PR campaign.
Let's talk about that. I mean, we had a conversation with Christina Wilfor and Lucina D'Amico last year on this very topic. Amazing women who I know you know well. They, obviously, the conversation was really about gender disinformation. I would love for you to remind our audience what that was and then talk about the role of that in this Bell Pottinger experience.
Yeah, so there was a lot of gender disinformation. So gender disinformation is disinformation, particularly against women, which uses sexist tropes, that it's online violence against women, where, you know, if, for example, Kamala Harris, they would put out, if I could give an example to explain it, they'll say, you know, she is a B word. Here they'll put out photos of her, in a, you know, manipulate photos of her in a short skirt and be like, you know, this is a slut. So it's that kind of disinformation. And part of the Bell Pottinger campaign was a lot of disinformation, because South Africa has some of the top journalists in South Africa are women. So they would kind of manipulate images of them, sexualize them, spread lies, you know, this one sleeping with that one. So there was a big element of that.
Have you ever been a victim of gender disinformation?
I have, a lot. There was a political party that kind of joined the election in 2019, and their campaign was, Phumzile Van Dam is arrogant. She's violent and she's arrogant and she's all of this. And the way I reacted to it was, I fought. I think that's the story of my political career.
I was going to say, I think there's a theme here.
Yeah. And my response was, oh, really? Okay. You know, it was bad. There were bot campaigns. It was at a time when I just, what do you mean? Why am I suddenly a target? Me? Why am I at the tip of everyone's tongues? What am I doing? Why am I such a fear? Because I understood it came from a fear. It's like, I don't understand it. And I think that also helped me understand my profile and my, you know, because I was like, what do you mean, me? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? I don't have that much influence. But it helped me understand that, oh, maybe I do then. And maybe I do have a profile. Maybe I can say things. And maybe I do have a little bit more protection. And I can say these things. I can say things that people don't want to say, and I'll say them, because clearly I have a profile that I didn't know that I had.
I love that it helped you see your power. I love that, like, an organized, resourced campaign to silence you did the exact opposite.
It did the exact opposite, because I was like, oh, thank you. This is what you've done. What I think my reaction to it has kind of normalized it, in the sense that I was like, okay, so if this happens to you, you must just fight back. You must just, if they tell you to shut up, just speak louder. But it shouldn't be like that, because not everyone's like me. And it shouldn't be a barrier. I often wonder how many women are shut down in the social media space. You know, there's been research done about gender disinformation, how it actually silences women. They don't, women politicians in particular, they don't post as much. They give their accounts over to staff, and they do silence themselves. And it shouldn't be that way. And that's, I remember I was at a workshop and women were talking about how that's kind of a barrier to involvement. I was like, oh, well, just go ahead and just say whatever you want, but it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be a constant struggle, a constant fight. It shouldn't be that difficult to share your voice. And I think a lot of women actually leave social media when it's actually an important platform to build your profile, to get what you have to say out there, to set yourself out as an individual and not just, you know, square politician, to actually have people know you as a person. And social media is really important for that. And I think a lot of women are shut out of that space because of gender disinformation and online violence against women. And I think that's a difficult concept for men to understand. It's like violence is not only physical, it's psychological. If you're consistently bombarded with manipulated photos of yourself, you're called the B word, you're called this, it silences you.
In 2019, you were reelected. You were elected as National Assembly Whip, as you were the Shadow Minister of Communications and Digital Technologies Committee. In 2020, you became a member of the International Grand Committee of Disinformation. I hear you say that it did not silence you. Your resume reflects the same, right? Like, you clearly just stepped into more and more opportunity and influence despite the campaigns, despite the effort put to keep you in a box. What does the landscape and influence of gender disinformation look like in South Africa right now? I feel like we hear more and more about it in the past 5 years. I don't know that it's necessarily new, although you tell me, but we're definitely talking about it more. What does it look like now, and what is still missing from these conversations?
So it is alive and well, and the primary targets are journalists and women opinion makers, and they're routinely subjected to coordinated attacks. So I try to broach the subject of gender disinformation and online violence against women, and the response was quite vitriolic. It didn't make sense. And it was, you know, there's different like factions and on Twitter. So it was more like the right wing conservative male who just refused to understand this idea of online violence against women. And I think they reacted so strongly to it because it was a primary tool in their arsenal to say, you know, to attack people, to attack women, because they understood that was a tool to silence women. And with the opinion makers, for example, it would be women that speak up against racism, and they'll often be manipulated images. You know, there was this one woman who had a photo of her manipulated, which was a big dildo was photoshopped next to her. A lot of work is needed in South Africa to start that conversation. And I think it isn't one that has been spoken about enough for an issue that is alive and well, for an issue that is a tool in many an arsenal. Because, you know, some people will stand up and speak up, but other women will not. So I think sparking that conversation will make them uncomfortable, because knowing that people are aware that you're doing this and speaking out against it, but also the social media platforms themselves.
So I was going to say, I want to talk about the social media platforms, because you became known as the person who pounces on injustice. You earned the nickname Tiger Paws, and I want to hear, a great nickname, by the way. I like it.
Yeah.
I want to hear more about your effort to request that Facebook be summoned to the Parliament of South Africa. Tell us about how that unfolded.
The Facebook story. So was head of the South African election after January 6th in the US, and South Africa was headed towards an election. And obviously, social media and how they react or do not react to hate speech, to disinformation, was a challenge. So I thought, you know, the best way to kind of deal with this was to get social media platforms on board, to have a conversation, to say, these are our concerns as Parliament. How are you going to deal with those? So I think because of the international reputation I had, when I, you know, Parliament agreed with me that we need to summon them knowing that I was involved in this, made Facebook agree, for example. And it's something that they've resisted around the world. And it was without a lot of resistance that they agreed to come to Parliament. Google agreed. So we were going to have this conversation. And then at the 11th hour, Facebook pulled out because I think they were, maybe their headquarters was like, no, you know, we don't know what these people are going to say. And they wanted to postpone. Obviously, I was very upset about this. I wrote a statement saying, you know, displeasure, you know, backhand at the Global South. And my political party tried to get me to not say anything about that.
Why? What do you think the motivation was?
So I don't know for a fact what happened. But I know that Facebook invests a lot of money, for example, in the US on lobbying. So when I initially raised the subject of Parliament, of Facebook coming to Parliament, a lobbyist called me and said, you know, we're lobbyists representing Facebook, and they wanted to talk to me. And I said, no, I don't speak to lobbyists, particularly on such an important issue. If anyone from Facebook would like to speak to me, they can pick up the phone and talk to me. And I was like, you're not going to spin me. I'm just not going to do that. So what the reasoning was then from my political party, just say, I can't go after Facebook. They said, oh, no, Facebook's really great at removing disinformation. It's not funny, but that's how ridiculous it was. And I tried to explain, no, they're not that good. So what I figured happened was that a lobbyist found a ear that was perhaps not very familiar with the facts. Because they said that, you know, if I go after Facebook, Facebook's going to make their campaigning for the election very difficult. And after years of nonsense and my job being made incredibly difficult and constantly doing it anyway, that for me was a step too far. Because I was knowing what Facebook has done or turned a blind eye to, I couldn't go out there and be okay with what Facebook does and be part of a school of thought that saw Facebook as good at removing disinformation, of placing Facebook as having the power to say, if you do not do this, you know, we will not allow you to use our platform to campaign. Look, I knew that was not true, but clearly they reached an ear where they could say this and they had a willing ear. And I resigned because I'm not going to do that. So that kind of was when I decided I'm not going to do this anymore. I can't be forced into a position where I defend Facebook, knowing what they've done, knowing what happened in Myanmar, knowing that they have a massive disinformation problem, knowing that despite knowing that they actually can't stop you from using their platform to campaign, but knowing the conversation that must have taken place for someone to be convinced of this position, and knowing that Facebook quite likely not only in my political party had the power to do that, but knowing that this is probably what they do around the world, I couldn't be placed in a position where I could be associated with that.
After so many years of activism and influence, was that a hard decision to come to?
It was an incredibly hard decision to make. I loved my job. I was good at it. I had to fight off so many attacks. But because I believed in what I did, it was worth it. And because it stopped being about me, it was worth it. But there comes a point in life where you need to recognize your own value. And at that time where I had grown, after, you know, I had grown to understand that clearly I have a big profile and that's why they can have coordinated bot attacks, of knowing what had helped to do with Bell Pottinger, of being on the Grand Committee of Disinformation, on being the first legislator to successfully summon Facebook to Parliament in Africa, knowing what I can actually do. it made the decision a little bit easier to make, and that I knew that even if I leave the space, I could still continue with my work, knowing that I still had a platform to hold big tech accountable, to speak about disinformation, and not having to be in this toxic space made it a little bit easier. But it was very, very, very hard decision to make, particularly knowing that I could have stayed and fight and fought. But the cause was bigger than that particular space. I could fight it internationally and be free to say what I want to say without being confined to a very small space.
I have known you for like an hour. What is it, 90 minutes? I don't know. It's great. I love every minute. I don't want it to end.
Me too. It's so much fun.
And hearing you talk about that resignation simultaneously makes me so sad for what your government lost when you stepped out of that leadership role. So sad that they're missing out now on that influence. And yet so proud of you for being able to say enough is enough.
You're gonna make me cry.
Like, you know, like, I'm not gonna stand in the fire forever. You can't keep burning me. And for having the sense of self-worth enough to step aside, to prioritize that for a minute.
Yeah, I've healed from it, but it wasn't easy.
What are the consequences to society when we silence women's voices in these ways?
No, you just lose people that are, you lose talent, skills, education. You lose so much. And for what? What have you lost it for? So you can feel as a mediocre man that, oh, you know, here's this person who, what's the quote? You shouldn't have to dim your light to make somebody else shine. Where, what, so you've gotten rid of, you've silenced this woman who did so much good for your own ego. Is your ego that much more important than the effectiveness of a particular woman? And it really pains me that this is the story of so many women, of women in the public sector, of women in the private sector, that our lives are a perpetual war that we need to fight. But what always comforts me is knowing that there were women who came before me who had their own struggles that they fought for me to make it easier for me. And I need to fight on for women that will come behind me to make it easier for them.
Like what you're hearing on Breaking Glass? Do us a favor and share this episode far and wide. Leave a review for the show wherever you listen to podcasts, and be sure to sign up for our newsletter. We promise to round up the very best resources on issues affecting women around the world so that we can all be just a little bit more educated and a whole hell of a lot more empathetic toward one another. It's also worth mentioning that Breaking Glass is a production of Evoke Media. Evoke is a nonprofit organization that exists in order to elevate the people and stories that are working to make the world a more unified and equitable place. Learn more at weareevokemedia.com.